I'm Cape.
And I'm Drew.
We're just two former student athletes who understand the game.
Not just on the court.
But in life.
At the end of the day, we just want to help.
Today's athletes and former just trying to find their way.
It's bigger than sports.
This is the Cape and Drew Podcast, the real TikTok. What's up, everybody? I'm Cape.
I'm Drew. And today we have episode 14, you know, Breaking the Stigma. So it's Mental Health Awareness Month, and we just kind of want to do a special about that. We're fortunate enough today to have Miss Dr. Marie Ross Alexander from the Ross Group, also from North Carolina Central University. How are you doing today, Dr. Alexander?
I'm doing good. It's Mari, Drew.
Oh, sorry. Dr. Mari Alexander, I apologize. But it's great to have you. So how are you doing during these, you know, these COVID times?
I'm doing well. I'm just messing with you. I answer to everything. But my kids get upset when I don't correct people, so I try to get better at that.
Wait, well, what is it so I don't mess up?
It's Mari.
So call you Mari?
Yeah, so it's Mari-O without the O.
Okay.
Mari.
Right. I first tried to learn her name. She gave me, like, all of it. One time I was like, hold on, you have four names? No, just... But it's just great to have you on here. You know, I was doing some background information on you, and I found out you had three kids. And I was like, I didn't know she had kids.
But I do.
The thing was, I was listening to this interview you did, and you said you had a son that played at UT.
Yep.
And I was just all like, that is so crazy. And I can remember you were like, one thing y'all did, you know, no wasn't an acceptable answer in our house growing up.
Right.
And so that was kind of, I guess that could kind of bring us into our first question as far as developing that mindset, having a student athlete, married to an athlete. How did you kind of become involved with all of that?
Oh, gosh. So it goes way back. I ain't going to tell you how many years back it goes, but it goes way back to when I was a little girl. My dad had three girls, right? My dad was not a girly dad, though. He was a dad. Like, you know, if you want to hang out with dad, you're watching boxing and wrestling and fixing cars. And, you know, my first car was a stick because he's like, you're supposed to drive a stick. That's what men do. Like, daddy, but I'm not a man. You know, like, that's not not a man. But that's just how he was. So he is. And so he just, you know, he was the guy that fixed everything. And he was always watching some sport. That's just what was happening in our house. Football, basketball, baseball, whatever. So if you wanted to hang out with dad, You in essence had to be kind of a tomboy. And then my mother was one of 19 children, so there's a lot of them. And she was one of the oldest, so she's like the third oldest. So all my aunts and uncles are my age, and I was one of the few girls because there's a whole bunch of boys in the family, and all my cousins are all boys. So I just grew up, you know, throwing rocks and racing and wanting to be the fastest and competitive, and, you know. And so that was easy for me. So I played every sport out there. I did play basketball, even though I'm 5'1". I played basketball in high school until my sophomore year. Everybody kept growing and I didn't. So I gave up that dream. But, you know, I cheered competitively. I was a gymnast. I mean, I was just always active. So that was just part of growing up. Went on to school and I cheered competitively in college. And working athletics, because that was what I liked to do. That's what I enjoyed doing. So I was an academic, not academic advisor, but a tutor at Arizona State while I was there, and worked in the athletic department. I worked with one of the ADs. And so just always loved the atmosphere. I loved the competitiveness. I was at a PWI where there was very few Black people, you know, obviously. And so we had a real tight-knit unit of Black students, and almost all of them were athletes. So That's just who you hung out with. This is what you did. And so you were cheering them on the game and tutoring them after the game. And that was just my life. And so my husband actually, excuse me, was trying out for the Cardinals. And so at Arizona State, the Cardinals and Arizona State were very much intertwined. So they practiced at our facilities, they used our stadium, all that stuff way back in the day. So again, being Black and in Tempe, Arizona, there's only like five Black people. So we all knew each other. we all knew each other. So, you know, it was kind of destined to happen because we all kind of hung out in the same circles. And so I met him and he thought I was the cutest thing on earth. So he says. You know, it was a natural fit. I mean, I wasn't starstruck, obviously, because I grew up around all kind of boxers and stuff. I'm from Las Vegas, so, you know, entertainment was the name of the game. You know, seeing stars all over the place was easy, but he was just a really smart guy. He's a computer science engineer, so he was a brainiac, but he also liked sports, so we kind of fit because I'm a brainiac and I also love sports. Yeah. So, you know.
That's actually pretty awesome. We're
still doing this thing.
If I had to guess your background, I would not have guessed any of that.
Yeah, nobody does. They're like, what? Okay, you did too much. Yes.
I'm still stuck on the 5'1 basketball and the 19 uncles and
Nobody believes the basketball until I show them pictures. I'm like, I have a picture. I was on the team. I actually played, you know. But
I got you. And I'm assuming you was a point guard, not a center, right?
Right.
Please don't say that.
Exactly. They didn't want none of this on the post.
I think we still, but the first thing we definitely want to check in with you about this COVID. Like, how are you holding up? How's everything going?
You know, I personally am doing well. I've been doing telemed for years now. So this is not new for my world. You know, I support 15 different schools and most of it's telephonic. You know, I'm jumping on a Zoom or a FaceTime because our athletes, that screen time is what they do. That is what they do. And they've been doing that for a while. So I had to adapt a long time ago to reaching my students that way, my student athletes. You know, most of them, I could be in the same building, like at TSU, I could be in the same building and the door next door, and they still would say, can we FaceTime? I'm like, but you can just walk over to the office. They're like, no, Dr. Mark, can we just FaceTime? So I've been used to that. I don't like being at home. I like the energy of students and student athletes. So I don't like that part of it. I'm just, you know, I'm very big into self-care. So I definitely separate my life out. I don't work all day. I don't take work home after I'm off. You know, I do crazy things like at 5 o'clock, I will get in my car and drive back home. Like I, you know, just take a drive. And that's like, okay, that's my cognitive way of saying it's time to turn off from work. Mm-hmm. And I really try hard not to work after I'm off.
That's so interesting you say that, because I think in this new virtual world we're all living from, we all have those different platforms. Like, I know y'all use WebEx, use Microsoft Teams and other, you know, these other platforms. But because we're so virtual now, people have more of an access to you like they did before. You know, they did before with email and, you know, phone. But I think it's different now where people don't know how to unplug at 5. And they sometimes expect you to be plugged in. So they might send you a little message or a little chat thing. And I'm like, yo, if the house ain't on fire, I get back to Florida, yo. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
It's difficult, though, because you got some, if you're a new employee, you don't know. You think if somebody reaches out to you, that you better respond like it's urgent. You're like, that can wait, yo. Because if it was that serious, they have to call you.
Right. And, you know, it's so funny you say that because, you know, in my units, I tell my staff that. And even though we have student health, which deals with, you know, medical issues, nothing we do is life and death. So stop treating it like that. Like, I'm not going to treat it like that. I need you not to treat it like that. It can wait. Whatever we're doing can wait. And so I have pretty strict boundaries around that for them and for me so that we can all, you know, be sane at the end of all this, right? Be ready for that.
We know you have your own, like, company, right? The Ross Group.
Mm-hmm.
But how did you become, like, involved working with athletes, but also like centered around kind of like mental health?
So this is a really long story. I'm going to condense it down to a couple minutes. I first was in law and I thought that I could save the world by, you know, defending people when they came into the courthouse. And I
law
learned
school.
Very, yeah, law. I'm telling you, I've done about 5,000 other things. I've done a lot of, I had like 16,000 jobs. And, you know, but, you know, what's so funny about that, I'll tell you that in a second, but what's so funny about that is that I often will tell my student athletes or my, you know, my clients that, you know, this life is about exploration. You have to explore what you think you might be interested in, or you really lose the opportunity to find your passion. Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm very big on taking chances and taking those opportunities just to see, is this something I really want to do? Now, I found out 15,999 of them I did not want to do, but it was important.
And we have some stories for you.
Right. It really built up my repertoire of being able to do a lot of different things or to think differently in different capacities. So anyway, long story short, thought I wanted to do that and found out very quickly that Black and brown people, and I think I told you, I grew up with, you know, mostly males in my world. And so most of my cousins have visited the jailhouse, if not the prison. Like, you know, they that's just kind of the life that they've chosen or has been railroaded. They've been pipelined to, right? You know, that's kind of how things work. And so I had this heart and this passion for Black boys, like, you know, my cousins and my uncles and all these people. So in law, I thought, okay, I can affect change there. I can help them get out of trouble. What I realized is that the pipeline happened way before they got there. You know, how, you know, the thought processes, the communities, all that stuff was all kind of designed to help them be in the courthouse. And so I realized that it was a very frustrating process for me. I didn't like courtrooms or judges or deals and all the things that happen behind the scenes. So, you know, went to my boss and said, yeah, this is not what I want to do. I quit. He was like, sure, you can quit. However, you know, we pay for part of your school, so you have to pay us back. Mm-hmm. And that's just one thing I don't do. So once it's my money, it is my money. So I said, okay, well, just give me something else to do that will, you know, facilitate my work here, but yeah, do not make me do that anymore. And so she gave me what became my Bible, which is a DSM. You know, it's a diagnostic tool for therapists and for psychologists to diagnose people. She said, I can tell you that everybody that you see in that court, in that jail, they are in this book. They are somewhere in the book. And that was true. Somewhere in the book, it made so much sense about how they got there. Right. And so I said, you know, I want to be on the other side. I want to be way before they get here. And so I was like, well, what do I got to do to do that? And it was go back to school and get a degree in psychology and all that fun stuff. So went back to school for 1,000 years and actually got into this for the purpose of healing their hurt. That was what I thought I wanted to do. And realized that, you know, Black boys are three places. They're in prison, they're dead, or they're in college. You know, those are the kind of the three. And if they're not in prison, they're kind of on their way there. You know what I'm saying? You know, just that lifestyle and things that was happening again back when I was in the mindset of what I was going to do. So I realized that the kids that could actually make a difference were in college. And, you know, majority of those kids at that time is about the numbers like 87-88% of Black boys in college were all in athletics. You know, that's where you're going to find them. And I was like, okay, this is a captive audience, right? They have to be here. And so really started, you know, bringing the love of sports, which I love. I was still doing things in sports. Obviously I was married to somebody who, you know, was playing the NFL, and I was the therapist of every team we went to, and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. So it was a natural fit to do this, where these Black boys were. And that was in sports, on a collegiate level. So that's how it all came full circle for me, in athletics, and then sought out to just do that and was able to do that.
That's just a dope story. I can remember, I listened to another one of your interviews about, you know, mental health and people talk about their problems. And I remember one thing you said, you know, you're only as sick as your secret.
Yeah.
It's like, because I know for us, Cape and I, we've been knowing each other since, 2002. We didn't really start talking about problems until like after like college, like as far as like being able to, hey man, let me bounce this idea off you. Think about right. This is what I'm going through, just because we always kind of had that, you gotta be tough or we can't be vulnerable.
right.
Yeah. A lot of that comes from, you know, just the narrative, you know, growing up. I mean, I could spend all day talking about how we're shaped and formed to be put in a box of what masculinity and manhood is defined as. And then if you grow up playing sports, it's almost like times 10, because like to Drew's point, you gotta be the toughest
son of a gun out there. You're not to, you know, if you're running suicides and you feel like you're about to pass out, you better not. You got to keep going. And it's the culture. We talk a lot about that on this pod, about just the culture of sports. And, you know, it's just such a, it's just tough, man. And if you're not, if you don't have anything else going for you, you'll think that you have to be a certain way and you have to behave on and off the field, on and off the court to to be a man. And those type of norms are just ridiculous. I say that being far removed from that, but I still see it happening on my campus where I work. It's just hyper masculine. And, you know, I work at the University of South Carolina, and SEC football, you know, the football players are gods. I mean, it's just what it is. And I run into a few of them, not a lot, and I'm just, every time I get a chance to talk to them, I talk to them about sports because that's my way in, you know, just to kind of get close to them and start a conversation. But I'm also looking at them like they always look tired. They always look drained. They always look like they can't move because they just did a million squats. And I'm like, God, I don't miss that. God, I don't miss that at all. But I'm like, I hope you're going to class. I hope you're doing internships. I hope you're talking to somebody like you to you know, not let all that stuff, because I can only imagine how crazy it is on that level with social media now, how that messes with your psyche, the pressure to go pro, of course, and all of that. But, you know, I wish I would have had somebody like you. So that leads into the next question, though. So it's not always been a real high focus of sports to have somebody like you working with students. Right. It's not all, or professionals for that matter. But now you see, you know, like Kevin Love, DeRozan, a couple of names that just come off the top of my head that have come out and spoke about mental health. And you think, the first thing I thought about, I'm not going to lie to you, I was like, mental health, man, you're making millions of dollars. What's wrong?
What's wrong with you?
You have problems, my man. Come to my world. Come to my world. But you hear them talk about just the pressure, the expectations, the traveling with the team. You don't necessarily get along with all the players, but you got to put on this, you got to put on this happy face all the time because of the video, the cameras, and you're always in the limelight. So can you talk about just where, you know, it's, you know, how far have we literally come from when there was nobody like you working with the teams to now? And have you seen, you know, just the progress over the years?
Well, we made tremendous progress. I mean, there was a time, obviously, there was nobody that looked like me at all. And not only looked like me as far as a psychologist, but being a Black psychologist was a whole nother, that we're still way behind when it comes to that. And being a woman in male-dominated sports and things like that, just, you know, we're still working on that. But there was a time where you were crazy, you know, if you saw somebody like me. Now I have coaches calling saying, how can I get my team tough and this and that and all these other things, and, you know, they're weak, and, you know, and I spend more of my time dealing with the coaches than I actually deal with the players. And I think that, you know, counseling and psychology and behavioral health and mental health is just more accepted, period, just across the board. Mm-hmm. The student athletes are asking for it, so the coaches have no choice but to provide it. And, you know, just the awareness, social media, all these things that bring all this information to them pretty regularly. And we have lots of people out there, not just in sports, but just in, you know, in celebrity, that are talking about mental health and talking about their battles that they have alone. Katy Perry, I was watching something on her last week, and she was talking about how she has been in depression, and, you know, she didn't even think she wanted to live, and now she's having a baby and giving new life and all this other stuff. And so, you know, we've come leaps and bounds. We still have a far way to go, because most of my teams call me when it's crisis. They don't call me for preventative. They don't call me for evaluatory things that can happen ahead of time, right? So, you know, I brag on my Campbell. Those are my babies. I brag on Campbell University, and Coach Min and I are great friends. He's actually one of my best friends. And so, you know, we've been able to really kind of figure the whole thing out, where I'm a part of the entire process. So I meet these athletes before they even commit to the school. You know, I'm understanding who they are. I mean, I don't give my coaches evaluations until after they sign, so that there's no... you know, that they're not judged on what I know, right? But it gives me a game plan, a blueprint for how to help this athlete acclimate to this college campus, acclimate to the team, because I know the team and how they work, acclimate to the coaches, because I know how the coaches work, and then actually develop them as a person, you know, like as a human being, not an athlete. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, again, leaps and bounds. We have a long way to go. More teams, you know, the NBA now has this rule that everybody has to have a therapist on retainer, mm-hmm. which, you know, is great in theory, right? But what does that mean?
Right.
Because yeah. I can be on retainer. You can give me a check for $500. That's retainer. And you never, ever use me. You give me a check for $20,000 and never, ever use me. And then what kind of therapist are we actually getting, you know, are they getting people who are going to dig deep and help these athletes really get to be a better person? Because sports are always going to end. They always end. It ends every time.
Always.
It's like always. Death. It's going to happen.
Yeah. And to your point about the coaches, let me just ask you a question. Are the coaches concerned about their student athlete? Say like their star running back, for instance, or star mm-hmm. point guard, is coming to see you regularly to talk about or to give it. Does the coach become concerned about the student athlete from that aspect, or is he or she glad that they're coming to see you and talk?
That has shifted. It used to be, don't touch him, don't talk to him, don't
That's
do nothing.
Why I asked. That's
good.
Why. Yeah.
Leave him alone. Right.
Right.
Leave him alone. Right. Leave him alone. Now it's gotten to, I want him to continue, so please help him continue being good.
Gotcha.
So it's really definitely shifted to, you're a help and not a hindrance. Gotcha. To the progress, because they see these kids burning out. They're a star athlete for 1-2 seasons. They're not the star athlete for 4. I mean, that just doesn't happen unless gotcha. They've done a lot of other work. And so coaches are starting to see that. And again, student athletes truly are positioning us really well because they're demanding mental health. So that helps that too.
Good.
I can remember when we were in school and we used to have like nightmares as far as if we knew we had this conditioning test the next day, or if I knew, you know, I got a big day of practice, you put all this stress on yourself and this pressure on yourself, and then I couldn't imagine being like, hey coach, I'm gonna go talk to Dr. Mari and see, you know, they would have looked at me like, you don't want to be here. So just to see
right.
where it's yeah. come. But I guess at least my next one, like, how did you break that barrier as far as getting people to listen and understand, like, this is what the student athletes need?
So for me, I take every opportunity. Anytime I have an opportunity to talk about mental health of student athletes, I'm all about it. Like, that's just gonna be it for me. I think you mentioned that, you know, no is not an answer. So when people tell me no, I'm like, okay, help me understand why you wouldn't want this, you know, and give them the value proposition, right? Like, this is how it helps you. Let's try, let's see what happens. Or you know, I talk to their athletes, and then I get athletes calling me. I'll call the coach and say, hey, listen, 10 of your athletes reached out to me. Do you know that, you know, these guys are struggling with this? What? Oh my God, what can you do? So generally after that, it's a lot of psychoeducation, helping them understand. And really, if I can get the coach to let me talk to the coach, like if he lets me have a conversation with him and I can tell him why he's doing some of the things he's doing, he's like, oh yeah, yeah, you, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. And so again, it's just a continual conversation. So, you know, one of my sayings is that the ministry of presence produces the power of influence, right? So if I'm just present over and over and over again, eventually, you know, somebody will listen. And so I've just taken that to heart. And so, you know, it's just, I stay after it. Honestly, I stay after it every opportunity I get.
I'm trying to envision, Drew, I just follow you for a second. I'm trying to envision coming to our coach in college. Hey, let me talk to the real you and have a conversation with you about some of the things your players have mentioned about, and it's been a common theme, like there's a theme there. It's not like we, you know, just one student right. athlete said something. It was like 7 of us said the same thing, maybe in a different way, but the same thing. And you yeah. have a conversation with our coach saying, this is what it is, like, let's talk about it. I'm trying to imagine my coach.
You know what? She'll do? I can see her being like, hey, the answer you're giving me, I can tell you've said this 1,000 times to people. And it's like, that's not real. That's not a real answer.
It would have been so robotic and so like, yeah, today I've said this so many times and I know this works. Let me just say that. So the root of the problem would have never been, it would have almost been like he would have became more agitated and he would have punished us.
I'll tell you, the thing about it is majority of my coaches, almost all of them, the relationship was built on a crisis. Mm. Right? So that is usually my way in. It's like, coach, listen, this one right here, you got five of them. So we can just do it, you know, one at a time, five times, or we can actually deal with the team. And I'm not asking you to do it. I will do it. Because, I mean, that's just one more thing on their plate. They don't know how to do it anyway, and they don't know what to do with it when it happens. And so usually it's like I'm relieving you of that responsibility, right? So then coaches start calling me some of the most burly, I'm a man's man coaches. Can I talk to you about Joe? I think Joe is crazy. And I'm like, I'll be like, coach, he might be crazy, but let me figure that out. I will talk to Joe, and I'll let you know.
Yeah.
And usually it's just like, you can hear the sigh of relief. Okay, she got it. I don't have to worry about it. We good.
And really, I mean, you know, it's just like us working in higher ed. There's always something that we have to go to a training for. Right. You know, there's always something to do, right? And, you know, but we become better professionals because of it. We're able to serve our students better. And I'm sitting here while you're talking, I'm like, these coaches are so much better because of you or, you know, people like you having these kind of because most coaches just coach. They know basketball. They know football. They know their sport. They don't know about the psychology of really what's going on. And they're older sometimes, so they don't really know. There's a gap, an age gap anyway. And so, again, I laugh when I'm sitting there thinking you, imagine you talking to my coach, though. That's funny.
Now, listen, I have fired some coaches before. I will fire a coach in a heartbeat. Be like, coach, this is not working for either one of us. I'm not doing this with you. Like, you know, because my heart's for the athlete to be well, right? So if you're doing anything to hurt the athlete or prevent them from being well, it's not going to work. So, you know, your coach might have been one of those coaches. I'd be like, yeah, you call me when you're ready.
Yeah,
you know, I'm not mad at you, but just call me when you're ready. You're not ready for me, and that's okay.
Yeah,
I can definitely see that one. You ready to have a real conversation? We can talk.
Right.
What are some differences? And this was a really good question for me. I'm just curious. I think we both are, but what are some differences you see in working with men and female athletes?
Oh. I dare say this on the record, but my male athletes are so easy. I mean, and I think part of it is, it's kind of like they see me as mama at first, you know, it's kind of like, oh, that's mama. I can talk to her about stuff. She ain't gonna tell nobody, you know, I can say things I would never tell anybody else. So it really is very easy, very respectful. Usually, you know, my women, wow. I got to work for that. I got to work for the relationship. I got to work for the trust. I mean, they really are a tough, tough group, you know?
Wow.
And so, you know, I've recently gotten a lot of women's basketball teams. That's just my new thing, I guess. I don't know. I'm the you know, girl of the hour right now with women's basketball. And so, I mean, It really is me building what we call a therapeutic alliance. So I really spend a lot of time massaging the relationship, letting them know I'm there. You know, they test you. My girl's testing me. My guys don't test me. Is she really going to be there? Let me see, you know. And then they'll call me at some random hour. I had somebody, in fact, it was so funny, one of my teams, she called me probably 12:30 one night, night before last. And I really was asleep. Like, I was dog sleep. And she didn't call me. She texted me. And I always tell them, if you text me and it's important and it's late, either text me several times or just call me because I got to hear the phone, you know? And so she just texted me like, well, what are you doing? What am I doing? You know, like, why are you asking me this? Which is code for, I want to talk, you know? And so it was a test. That's what they do. My guys, they just I got a problem. This is what it is. What you gonna do about it?
I can see that.
And it's easier to move them too. It's easier for them to get buy in and let's go. You know, my girls, they want to know why we're doing it, how we're doing it, can we do it a different way? You know, so they're much more in the process of it all. But I love both of them, but just one is a little, you know, a little more agreeable.
I can tell you right now, I would much rather talk to a female about my problems than a male, especially in college. Because if I was talking to a dude about my problems and he said something I like, I think he was trying to try me. Like, I would think he's just thinking he's a better man than me and trying to tell me. That's just me. That's my side.
Right.
But a woman, I'm like, she really, like you said, like the mother or older sister, I'm like, she cares. Like, she's telling me something that, like, you're more nurturing. I think it's a nurturing thing. A
right.
dude would be like, yo, what, are you trying to fight? I'm like, why are you trying to fight?
You're trying to fight. You trying to get this.
And it's so interesting. When I used to see you like interacting with students, even when you just started, it would seem like they had known you for so long. It was just like that natural, like nurturing environment. I was like, okay. But now I can see you saying, like, yes, but the women you really gotta work
with. I work for that. They make me work. I'm like, oh my gosh, okay. But I mean, I love it. I get it. I understand. I don't take it personal, obviously. But yeah, they're a lot of work.
Yeah.
So with everything going on now, right, how are your like interactions been with like student athletes trying to deal with this and get over this? And 'cause some people's careers have literally ended with this.
Yeah. You know, it hasn't changed much for me as far as student athletes are concerned. Now, my coaches are all on 10. Like, if there's more than 10, they're on more than that, like whatever that is. They are stressed out, concerned, not necessarily for their job, but how to keep their teams intact.
Okay, yeah.
But the athletes are actually doing just fine, you know?
Really?
Yeah. Now, part of it I'm concerned is kind of this is like being in shock. Like they don't really know the impact quite yet.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of waiting, embracing myself for what happens next. You know, because you got to think, the NCAA extended the year for like my baseball kids, my softball girls and things like that. So their life hasn't changed yet because they can actually come back and play another year.
Yep.
Basketball was still kind of, they haven't really, you know, the season was technically over. They were in the offseason. They were going to the postseason.
Right.
So a lot of them had already done the morning of my season's over. So you only had those few teams that were going to the tournament that were impacted. So like SEMO, I work with SEMO women's basketball, and they made it to the tournament. So that, you know, of course, this is her first year making it, or the head coach, she was pretty devastated by that. You know, the student athletes were upset, but most of them are going to be back next year. So they're like, well, we'll get it next year. So I just think my athletes haven't quite hit the wall with it quite yet. Not yet. I'm waiting. It's going to happen.
I would imagine some of them, maybe, just maybe, they were kind of, they wanted a break, maybe. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Like,
I tried to.
You said it, I didn't.
Yeah, I'm like, if it would have ended, I'd be like, what? We get to go back home? No practice? No what? Like, depending on where I was as a student athlete, I would, now, if I was the star, I'd be like, wait, you know, I want to.
This is my shot.
It's my shot, the NCAA tournament, whatever the sport is. But if it was like how I was in college, I'd be like, yo, it would have been cool.
But really, logistically, the sport that was impacted the most by COVID is postseason basketball.
Right.
Mm.
Right.
Everybody else, either their season was already over or their season never even began. True. So the ones that never began, they're like, I'll just play next year. Because kids are resilient. They are way more resilient than we are.
Especially student athletes. Especially those that play sports. They are like, man, we'll be all right. Everything is all right. Everything is fine.
We got this. We're good. Now, if football doesn't happen this season, now, that's a different story. That's going to be real.
Go ahead, Drew.
You don't even really want to have that conversation just thinking about it like,
how is it going to happen? How can it happen is my question. How can it happen?
Well, like we talked about before we got into this conversation, it's gonna, I mean, off the record, on the record, it's gonna be one of those, they're just gonna play. As long as they know, if you ain't dead or dying, you're gonna play.
And me and Drew talked about this on the last episode. You let a student athlete die from this thing, or a quarterback, a face of a program. God forbid, this is not what I want to happen.
No, right, absolutely.
But if that happens, and if that's what the NCAA or schools or conferences, because the NCAA is basically said, correct me if I'm wrong, facilities can open, right? But I'm leaving the decision open for each conference or each school or each whatever. Like, they don't, which I think is smart, because so, they're not liable, right? Y'all do what's best for you. For once, they're gonna leave it up to somebody. But you let one of these student athletes, one a face of a program, face of a conference, mm-hmm. All American, supposed to be drafted, and something happens. How can you answer to that? How can you, as a conference, as a program, as a staff, as a whatever, answer to that? You can't.
That is really kind of how mental health happened, though, with NCAA and how it's rolling out.
Mm-hmm.
We needed it. They said, oh, they'll be all right. Don't worry about it. This, that, another. Then you have a couple high profile kill themselves. And now we're pressed to have mental health in NCAA. So unfortunately, college athletics tends to be responsive and not proactive. Like I told you, you know, I get the crisis. I don't get the proactive, you know, I have the four best practices of NCAA, you know, in my brain. I know what they are. And one of them is pre-assessment. That means before, assess before. Pre-assessment means assess before, right? and I know that majority of these teams are not assessing before, right?
Mm-hmm. Not at all. I'm just really worried that we get stuck in the mindset of like, they'll be fine. They can get through it. They can fight through it. They had a couple of college coaches take some heat for that. Like, I need my guys here. They're young. They'll get over it. Versus that now you're seeing like just imagine the O lineman getting it who might have
pre-existing conditions.
Like that, right?
Right.
And, you know, I will say that I'm in the mindset of most of the coaches when I say that our kids will be fine. They're healthy. They're strong. Most likely, they will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
But the coaching staff and the folks serving the coaching staff,
those
are the people I really am concerned about. I mean, at the campus I'm at, I'm not worried about the students coming back. I mean, granted, I think it's going to be a nightmare, but I'm not really worried about them. I worry about the faculty and the staff who have to take care of these students.
Preach.
Those are the ones that are going to be on the news, you know? And I don't know what you do with that when you have a head coach that's in his 60s.
Right.
Who gets this.
That high risk, because even the janitors, I mean, some, you know, the people that work in Aramark or the food service.
Right.
You know, either faculties, the staff. I mean, anybody that's on a college campus, for the most part, I don't know what the percentage is. I read something the other day, but it's a good significant amount, especially the faculty side. That's
right.
Like 65, 60, 65, that they got a couple more years and then they're going to take it to the house. But,
right.
And then, you know, this ain't a part of what we want to talk about. I just have a question because I think you're very intelligent. So how is this going to happen? Just picture us being in a classroom, right? And I'm sure y'all's university is working on some policies and procedures. We are too. But if it's not mandated, it's highly recommended you wear your face covering, your mask, your PPE equipment. Yes, right? We're going to give you one too. We're going to spend thousands of dollars to give you one. We're in a class, face-to-face class setting, and the professor's in there. Let's just say it's me. I'm 60 years old. And a student refuses to wear it, right? Now, I'm concerned because maybe I have some pre-existing conditions and I'm afraid. And this student, I see him nose running, coughing, sneezing, particles everywhere. Now, do I excuse myself, excuse the class? Do I excuse that student? Like, how can you control young people from doing what young people are gonna do?
You can't.
That's all
right?
I
mean, that's the, and you know, and they ask, you know, my title is student health and well-being. Like, I have this title about making sure everybody, all the students on campus are healthy. And I get asked this question every single day, and every single day my answer is the exact same. You can't.
You can't.
It's impossible. I mean, not to get too far off the tangent and not to be too graphic, but I run a whole student health center that has STI testing every day because these kids don't realize that you got to wrap it up. You got to take, you can't keep doing it without any protection. They still do it without protection. They know the consequences. Mm. And a couple of those consequences are death, like actual death. Well, and they still, and some you can't get rid of. I mean, and it, we have lots of education around it. We have lots of presentations around it. We have condoms everywhere in every inch of campus. And they still participate the way they want to participate.
Right.
Mm. And we've been preaching that for years. So if we can't get that done, I'm not real sure I can get somebody to wear a mask.
Right.
I mean, it's not going to happen. So really it is about, you know, how can we do this as safe as possible, as possible, and hope for the best, really. It's quite scary, but that's what we're doing.
Yeah. I think every university administrators are just like, we're going to have a plan. We're going to implement the plan, and we're going to educate. We're going to do those three, and when they can't say that we didn't do our part. Now, right. The responsibility, we're going to trust our young people, because the worst thing we can say, we don't want to not reopen, and so they can say, well, you didn't give us a chance. So we're going to reopen, give you a chance, but this is my opinion on the record. I don't see us getting through the fall. At a school like mine, you know, I'm hopeful and I'm prayed up. I pray all the time, optimistic, but I don't know how you bring 36,000 students back. And, you know, most of them live off campus, by the way. I don't know how you control, and our community in Columbia is, you know, there's some elderly folks around here. I don't know how you you can educate all day, but to your point, people are going to do what they want. It ain't just the young people. It ain't just students, by the way.
Oh, no.
You know.
You see the videos of these folks out in these different places? No masks, no nothing. It is. You know, there was a, I don't know what her title was, but she was in the Bahamas, one of the leaders of the Bahamas, and she basically got on TV, the little nationwide TV, and told everybody to go to the grocery store and get 2 weeks worth of food because she was getting ready to shut it all down, everything. Mm-hmm. Everything shut down, 2 weeks. Mm. You will not go to, nobody was going anywhere. Not grocery store, not gas station, nothing. Everything shut down. And then she said, after, you know, at the end of the 2 weeks, if we're looking good, we will start slowly bringing people back. If we're not, we're gonna let you go, we're gonna open the grocery store one more time for get 2 weeks more worth of food and then shutting it down. And so, you know, that's really the only way to do it.
Yeah.
Outside of shutting it all down and letting this thing pass, we have to just put things in place, hope for the best, stay prayed up, and get ready to shut it down as soon as we see the outbreaks happen.
Absolutely.
Because that's what's going to happen.
And hopefully we can just get through football season. That's what everybody want to do.
Oh, wait. Now, the last thing I heard on football was that they were talking about just playing conference games. So basically delaying the season, because, you know, those first 4, 5, 6 games are all just, you know, money and, you know, fun games or whatever.
Get ready games.
Right. And just basically pushing the season all the way to conference play and only playing the conference games. Now, I could almost see that happening.
See that.
If we didn't have the kids come back to school. But because we have the kids coming back to school, it's all the same. They're all just, you know, in Petri dishes.
That seems like the more realistic thing to do, because I don't think people are taking into account, like, Cape and I know about this, you probably know about this, like, these guys are normally on campus during the summer, working out, doing all these things. Spring ball, I think, probably either got canceled, they got cut short, so.
It got canceled. Like, they all had just started, like, that first week of spring ball, and then it got canceled.
So you can't just be like, okay, cool, season's on, regular, you guys can go, like, and expect to be, like, to be able to function, so. I definitely think they're going to take that time to try to work into some type of rhythm, condition, and then start conference. But like you said, if it breaks out in the locker room, it could be the team manager get it, and then boom.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Very much so. I'll go next, Drew. So this, yeah, I'm glad this is my question because I definitely had a lot of trauma in my post-career. But so it seems a lot of athletes, like after they're done, they deal with, or they have some sort of past trauma in their lives. How do you begin the process of working through that and to help them in the present day? Because we know, you know, especially the black males, they come from circumstances where, you know, they might have four or five brothers and sisters, or if daddy wasn't there, or they saw their mom struggle, or maybe they had a rough, they were in the gangs or on the streets or homeless. You know, how do you help those student athletes unpack to kind of like, you know, start over?
So, you know, I feel like every team that I work for, every athlete, we have an obligation to make them better than when they came from, you know, whatever that is. Even if they came from two parent household and they had a ton of money, I still need to make them better. And that might be developing empathy for that one because he might not have it because he already had everything. Whereas I have to help somebody who's been, you know, witnessed or been a part of traumatic experiences. So, you know, first of all, it's just baseline. Like, I need to know where they come from. So, you know, again, I go back to Campbell just because that is the model. If any team wants to know how to do it right, they need to look at what Campbell football is doing, right? So, like I said, I get contact with students before they ever step foot on campus, truly. I mean, in the recruiting process, I'm a part of that. I get to meet parents. I get to meet the athlete. I get to understand them. I have a whole assessment they take. It's 120 questions. They all hate it, but they do it anyway. and then that gives me a snapshot of where they've been. I do an ACEs, so I know their adverse childhood experiences. I have record of that information. I do a short clinical interview after they finish that. So I've actually put eyes on them a few times at that point. You know, so the recruiting trips, I'm there. And then after I do this assessment, we do this interview and I get to see them again. They then have access to me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, and I start working with those young people before they come for spring ball, or not spring ball, but a summer ball.
Okay.
So when I'm working with the spring ball guys, I'm also working with this new group of either transfer or new students. And so I get to really know my athletes. Like, I know these kids, I know what's going on with them. I know when, you know, so-and-so got girlfriend pregnant and dad kicked him out of the house, he can't go back home. I also know, you know, Johnny, whose daddy has never been in his life, right? So what I do is I take all of those pieces and I develop what we're going to do as a team for the year on the personal development front, but also what my coaches need to do, because I'm not going to be daddy to Johnny, never. I can be a mother figure, I can be a nurturer, but I cannot be daddy, and I think daddies are important people, right?
Right.
But my coaches can, and I fully expect them to do that. Like, that's their job. I'm talking to coach and saying, coach, which one of your coaches is going to play this role for him? Because this is what he needs, yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And so that group, that particular team is really good at all of those things, right? Yeah. So I have one coach that he's never going to be the confrontational guy on Campbell's team, never. But he's the guy that will sit with you and go fishing. Mm-hmm. Right? So those kids that need to go sit and go fishing, they don't need to talk. They just need somebody to be there. Mm-hmm. He's the one that hooks up with them. It doesn't matter their position, because I don't care what position they play. I don't care if they play football, period. You know, it's not about the position. It's about the personality and who can really affect change for this young man. Mm-hmm. Right? So they are bought in. My coaches are bought in there. So to answer your question, it's the village, right? It's the village approach for me. I can unpack the actual trauma itself, but this person has to have corrective experiences after we get there. Okay, so yeah, your daddy used to beat the hell out of you. This guy's not gonna beat the hell out of you, but he's still gonna talk to you and tell you what you need to do.
Right.
And sometimes it's gonna be stern and sometimes it's not. And sometimes, you know, and we get to unpack it that way. So it's definitely individualized to the athlete I'm talking to, but as a global mission, I guess, it is this village that comes together. And we all play a different role for each athlete, depending on where they come from.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's great. I just feel like my freshman year, right, if I would have met with you, I would have probably been so locked in on trying to tell you what you wanted to hear. Just so we could just get done with this. And I feel like I got weights, I'm missing something. I'm looking back like, dang, I probably wouldn't have opened up at all, but that's probably exactly what I would have needed.
You'd be surprised though, right? Because I don't go in and just, I'm not like, okay, tell me your deepest, darkest secrets. Like that's not how it happens. Like I said, I spend a lot of time, like, you know, I travel with Campbell. So I'm at the games, I'm on the airplane, I'm on the bus, I'm everywhere, right? And I'm always asking. So like when I'll go up there on a Tuesday at 6 o'clock when they're out, and I'm sitting in the lobby. I'm like, hey, what's up? How you, Grace? What's going on? You know, and you know, something will jar a conversation,
right?
And we start talking, and it just kind of happens. So it's not this intrusive, tell me what's going on with you. It is this person who's always around, who's always asking all these questions.
Yeah, the relationship. You know? I was going to say, Drew, I agree with you. Freshman year, I'd have been like, man, let me go meet with her because I'm trying to get where I need to get to. You know what I'm saying? I would say sophomore, definitely by junior, senior year, yeah. I would have been in your office. I would have been the one
best friends.
I would have been, yes. Me and you would have been tight because then, you know, when you come in as a freshman, you still got your life. You're like, everything is golden. You know, I'm good. I'm about to be the man or woman. I'm straight. Then you start going to them practices and then them classes that you barely getting through or not getting through. Then something might hope happen at the crib. And man, where Dr. Mari at, man? I gotta get some stuff up. And then you start thinking about graduation. Like for me, I would have been like, what am I about to do after school? Like I would have been tripping about that. So yeah, freshmen, well, you know, yeah, they don't understand.
And part of that's the culture of the team, right? So my juniors and seniors are telling the freshmen, man, you need to talk to her. Man, she cool. You know, so they're I don't have to advertise no more. Like they're the ones saying, meet with her, right? Moms and dads are always like, did you talk to Dr. Mari? Like I'll be at the game. They're like, did Johnny come and tell you about such and such? I was like, I can't tell you if he did, but thank you for the endorsement. You know, so these freshmen usually have a lot of pressure to come talk to me. Right. And when they come talk to me, I'm like, listen, I don't want you to be pressured to come talk to me. I know everybody has told you that you need to come do this. I want you to come because you want to. Right. And sometimes you won't want to until you in the heat of it. But here's my number. Text me, call me, you know.
Do you notice, like, let's say someone is not doing well, performing well on, you know, their perspective for sport. Do you notice it having like a trickle-down effect with the rest of their life, like their grades, like their social?
Oh, yeah. I tell them, I said, so another, they have my Mariisms. So one of my Mariisms is that you will play how you practice everywhere in your life. However you practice everywhere in your life is how you're going to play. That's how it's going to be. So if you practice lazy in school, your grades are going to be lazy on the test. Grades are going to be just as lazy as you are on the test. So, and so really, you know, what I do is really, you know, coaches bring me in to make them better athletes. And I say, I can't make them a better athlete unless I make them a better person. So once they're a better person, athletics is easy because they're already good. Or you want to recruit them. You want to give them a scholarship.
Right.
Right. But now we got to take these little things. Like I have one athlete. I love him. Oh, he's one of my favorite. He's the cutest little boy. And he's so smart. Right. So what he does is he will calculate what's the lowest grade he can get an A.
Sounds like some stuff.
And I'm like, I was gonna shake him. I'm like, what do you mean? You are taking all that time to figure out what's the minimum you can do to be great. Right? The minimum. I'm like, what if you did the maximum?
Man, you remind me of my dad would say something like, you put all this energy in to try to take the easy way out. You just put that right the first time.
Right, so it's things like that I get to know these kids, and I can talk to them. I'm like, dude, come on now. Like, you are the leader of this team. Everybody can't do it like you and still succeed. So you got to show them the hard way to do it because it's easy for you. You know, but that's what it takes to really affect change for these young people, and freshmen included. Like I said, I don't have a problem with freshmen. But again, the way that in the team I love the most right now, anyway, I have had lots of points of contact with that freshman. They don't come on campus without already having spent some time with me. You see what I'm saying? So I mean, because they'll come in for a visit in, you know, what, November, October, November, then again in January. Right. I met them twice then I met again in March. We start working in April. By the time they actually physically come on campus in July, we spent 5-6 hours together. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a foreign person to those kids.
That's great.
I mean, I used to work with student athletes, and I don't know if you do this for yourself or not, but I always look at guys that I meet, and I'm like, that guy, he's not going to make it. Whether not necessarily he do something bad.
I would never say that.
He's going to transfer because I could just tell he's not buying in, and he just doesn't. How do you basically build that person back so they don't leave?
So I'm the queen of honest conversations. I'm like, dude, listen. Like I said, for my boys, my girls, I got to do it a different way. But my boys, I'm like, dude, listen, you're not going to make it here. We got to do some work to get you in a position to be successful here, right? Mm-hmm. I got to do some things. You got to do some things. I'm always willing as long as you are. When you stop being willing, then I leave you to your own devices and you'll figure it out, right? Mm-hmm. And so, most of my teams, we don't have that issue, but most of my teams, I've also trained my coaches. I've worked really hard to get them to understand what they need and want in a player instead of just getting the best athlete, right? We look at the athletes that are the best fit for their team, right? Which may not be the superstar, 5-star kid. It might be the 3-star kid who works really, really hard.
That makes a lot of sense. That definitely makes a lot of sense. Just figuring out what pieces to add to the puzzle to kind of make it complete. I guess to my next kind of question, like, what advice would you give student athletes who are now, they're done with their collegiate sports and they're getting ready to navigate the next step in life? Like, because for us, when we were coming up, our last game, boom, it ended, right? We didn't have any workouts. We didn't have any meetings after. And so you figure if we're talking to you all this time and then it just ends, we're going to feel this loss kind of. So do you still kind of continue that relationship with them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I still have athletes I talk to that are well beyond college. Like, they'll call me for all kind of random stuff. Some I talk to pretty regularly, and some is just a one-off. Hey, just want to talk to you. Hey, I want to tell you about this, that, and another. But once you're mine, like, forever. It's like a kid. They're my kids. They can be 35 years old. They need something. I'm there. But again, I developed the whole athlete. So it's not just about while they're playing, nor is it, do we wait till the last game to start talking about what you're getting ready to do? Like, I need to know what internships you've had, even though that's not my job, but I work with, their academic advisor. Hey, did so-and-so do this? This summer, he was really kind of just languishing. What are we doing with him? So I put my nose in lots of lanes about my athletes. So we, by the time their last game has happened, we've had many conversations about what's next.
Man. Okay. Do you remember your last game as far as even talking to a coach after that? It was more so like, I might pick up for you. I might respond, or I might get back. I don't know.
I'll just say this. I haven't talked.
Be careful.
I know. I'm fine, but I haven't talked to any of my coaches like in depthly. I put it to you this way: if it wasn't for social media, like Facebook back in the day, or I'm not really on Facebook like that, but just. Without that, I'm talking about a real coach calling, hey, Kate, man, what's going on? Just checking in with you. How's life doing? I saw the pictures, man. You're a daddy now. Anything. Ooh. I never, ever, ever have had that. I never had a coach just call and just shoot the you-know-what with me. Now, mind you, I was not a superstar at all, no, by no means. But I like to think that me and the Drews of the world were good kids. You know what I mean?
We were
the guys on the team that, if anything, you never had to worry about us. We was going to be where we were supposed to be on time. We was going to give it our best. Grades were okay. We did what we were supposed to do. But we were never the ones that were going to cause any problems. And so, and I just want to say this really quick. This came to mind while you were talking. I should have probably said this at the beginning, but I heard a coach say one time, and I was in high school. I think I was in 10th grade. I overheard him say to my father, so just give you some perspective. We're middle class, upper middle class, growing up, whatever, right? I heard him say, so he was talking about me. He was talking about being as a player. He was like, you know, your son is good, but he's, I just don't know if he's got that grind, that like dog, like he's not confrontational or whatever. And so my dad was like, what do you mean? He was like, well, to be honest with you, I take a kid from the hood before I take your son, even if they were on the same like level. And so, did we lose her? Or are you still?
No, I'm good.
Okay. I think she might be frozen, but that's okay.
Oh, yeah.
I lost you. Sorry.
That's okay.
You said to your father. Yeah. And that was
it. Okay, that's cool. I'll go back. So he was talking to my father, and he was basically telling him that, like, your son is good, but, you know, I don't know if he has, like, that dog in him. I don't know if he's, like, tough enough, whatever, that he can play. But he said, my dad was like, what do you mean? He said, well, to be honest with you, I take a kid from the hood or somebody from like low income or somebody like that than your son, because somebody like your son probably has something to lean back on or fall back on. And I remember that as a 10th grader, and I'm like, wait, what? Like, that kind of stuck with me. But that goes back to our conversation about, you know, manhood and where you're from and putting these, you know, social norms and putting you in a box type of stuff. And just from a psychological, and I'm like, look, fast forward, I had great parents, man. I really did. And I was able to fall back on to them just for like support, but I still didn't know what to do after sports. It's not like I fall back onto Trump Towers or something.
You know, right.
So, it's just interesting though, because Like again, I could totally see, and that's why I was glad to hear you say you still talk to some of the former athletes, because I would have definitely, I might need to go sit on your couch right now, to be honest.
Come on, I'm available. but you know, it goes back to what I said earlier, is that, you know, I've had 15,000 jobs, right?
Yeah.
And that was all a process of discovery. Like, okay, who am I? What am I? What am I here to do? What do I want to do? What do I enjoy? What don't I? You know, it's really important to find things that we enjoy doing.
Yeah.
Because then it's not a struggle to go do them, right? Yeah. It's not work. It's your passion. Yeah.
Right.
And so you can't know that without trying them on. You don't know that. It's not possible. So, you know, someone who knows what they want to do at 22 is a rare person. Really, they're very rare.
Thanks.
Even if it's, I want to play in the NFL or if I want to play in the NBA, it's still rare. Because even when they get there, they're like, this is not what I really thought it was going to be. Yeah. Like, you know, like, I don't really want to do this. And so that process of discovery is just so important. And Black children don't usually get enough exposure to even have an idea, right? We just don't have enough of that life experience. We don't go outside of our bubbles and things like that enough to truly know that. Yeah. So, you know, I preach that too to my athletes. Like, listen, you don't have to know. You have to get a degree, but you don't have to know what you want to do. Okay, we can change this thing up. Trust me, Mari's done it. Changed it up several different times. Yeah. I mean, I'm a sports psychologist that's an ABC of a school. I mean, you know, it's like, that doesn't even make sense, but it works, right? I enjoy it. I'm having fun. And then when I stop having fun, I will stop doing it. I will discover something else about myself, I guess. But, you know, what's most heartbreaking, what you guys just said, though, to me, is that most of my coaches preach, and I've heard so many other coaches preach family. This is a family. And for you not to hear from, talk to, or anything after you played, but yet you are part of the family for, you know, these 4 or 5 years, that part is what I don't like. Those are the coaches I would fire. I'd be like, you know what, I can't with you, because this is really about developing this young person. And I just told you at 22, they're not developed. They don't know what they want to do. They think they know.
Our brains ain't even fully developed. They don't, what men brain don't develop to 26, 27?
30. No, I'm just kidding. Yes.
I keep in contact with one of my coaches throughout, even back to high school, college, and I went to two universities. Mind you, he's my first cousin.
That don't even count.
And the crazy thing is, now when I look back on it, like, we'll talk sometimes, you know, and I'll be like, you know what, man? I'm sorry for how I was, because I know when I was at that age, like my junior, senior year, I could have did so much more. And just like, you know, once you get a little bit mature, and you kind of like, that was tough. But like you said, my first coach, we haven't talked since the day I told him I was going to transfer. And so just, yeah, that whole family thing is kind of...
It's kind of a thing, right? They say that, but then when it's time, it's you know. And so I will say, you know, a couple of my coaches, two of my coaches for sure I know, really mean that. They really mean family. But you see it. It's not what they say. Those kids come back. Mm-hmm. They come back all the time. They're around the program all the time, even after they've left. That's how you know. You don't have to tell me. I can see it by those things occurring.
That's how you know. When a player comes back and it ain't no appointment, he just come back, what's up, coach? Ah, hugging and, oh, man, what's going on? That's when you know. But when it's not like that ever, it's no good, man. Some of us are still a little upset about that. Some of us.
As you should be, because that's what they sold you. They sold you that, right? And then it turned out to be something else.
Yeah. Not surprised, though. But anyway, what would you say to people who are aspiring to work with athletes in the future, maybe similar roles that you have or you've done?
You know, what it goes back to what we've been talking about. You have to have a passion for the athlete, not the fanfare, not the games, not the travel with the team. I mean, that part is work for me. It's like, oh, I got to get on this plane, I got to do this, another. But when I get to sit with my athletes and I get to see them move from one place to another, that's what, you know, makes my heart happy. You don't have to pay me to get that, right? Now you got to pay me, but not. I do have a lifestyle. But you really have to have a passion for sitting with these athletes. If you do what I do, and it's a 24-hour day, 7-day a week job, you don't have days off. I mean, you set boundaries, but you don't have days off because their problems don't have days off. Their problems don't say, I'm only going to show up at 2:00 on Tuesday.
Right.
You know, the problem happens usually at Saturday at, you know, 2 a.m. when the girlfriend broke up or the boyfriend walked out. Yeah. That's when they don't know how to handle, they don't know how to cope, and it's not related to football or related to basketball, but it's going to affect football and basketball if we don't get a handle on it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to think outside the box. You have to be able to be creative. There's no tradition, you know, traditional hours, but really the passion for the athlete themselves is really, really important.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I was going to ask you about the how often does that happen? How often is some of the mental breakdown because of a breakup with a partner or girlfriend, boyfriend?
Almost always. It's pretty significant. But this is the age that's what's happening, right? You know, high school is the puppy love. And now they're men and they're women and they know what they want. They're going to marry this person. Like, really? You know? And they don't realize that it's still that same kind of transition from when it was high school. So, probably if I had to put a percentage, 60% of my calls are relationship related.
It's crazy to me when you say like women give you a hard time, right? But mm-hmm. I always think like, so did they not kind of like look at you as someone like, man, I should really want to aspire to be like her? You know, you think about ABC. Sports psychologist, like
right.
The black doctor.
Once we get past that, it's like hazing. They haze you. That's probably the best way to say it. They haze you. Once you pass the test, then you are in like Flynn. Like, there's no problem. My boys don't haze me. Right? They just don't haze me. But 60% is relationship. The other 40%, no, I'll say 30% is parents, family of origin mm-hmm. stuff. And then 10% is actual coaching staff and their sport.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah. Most of it is unrelated to their sport, really.
I mean, and that kind of, yeah, I can see that. And so do the players only come talk to you or do they feel comfortable talking to the coaches? I mean, I know you're talking about building this community, this sense mm-hmm. of everything, but I still think that there's that piece of, I don't want to tell my coach because I don't want them to know. And also mm-hmm. I don't want them to hang it over my head.
Both.
Okay.
You know, I don't hold anything from my coaches that my coaches need to know.
Right.
But I also don't tell them everything, you know, like some things that just not their business. This is kind of like just a regular therapist. Like if they went to therapy outside of football, outside of sports, the therapist wouldn't be calling their boss and saying, hey, let me tell you about your employee. Yeah. But when it's something like a family of origin thing, a parent is missing, there's a death or something like that, where I need coaches to actually take some roles and be some roles, then I'm all about telling the coaches what they need to know. But I always make sure the athlete knows that that I'm talking to them about this. And generally I'll say, you know what, why don't we go talk to coach? And so we'll make an appointment with coach. And we sit in the room and talk to them about whatever, you know, whatever's going on. We've had to do that more times than I care to do. But that's generally when we have to disseminate information. I try to do it in that type of format.
That's good.
Okay. That's really good. Only thing I keep thinking about is that passion part you mentioned. And I just think back to like Cape and I, we used to talk for hours about the jobs that we had as far as like, man, this is not the answer.
It's not it. That's why you didn't know.
And it's so crazy because where we are now, it doesn't even feel like work. It just feels like, man, it's a breath of fresh air. I love going here. I love interacting with students. And like you said, going to a game now, because we used to live and die basketball. We used to watch games, watch the highlights, then talk for an hour about the game. Man, if I don't go to a game right now, it doesn't matter at all. Like, I care less about going to that game. But if you want me to go, all right, I'll go.
Right.
And that passion piece, I mean, you know, it's to your point, I think you're supposed to go through a lot of things to see and to experience some BS along the way, too. So then when you get into your purpose, passion, job, like me and Drew talk all the time, like to his point, we're so happy. There's not a bad day. You're going to pay me to go talk, go be around some young people, to give them some gems every now and then, just vibe. So many of my students put me up on new music. We talking shows, we talking Insecure, we talking, you know, anything that's popping. Y'all going to pay me for that? Not every now and again, as y'all know, we got to put together, do budget stuff or plan,
or you know,
in the year, whatever projections. But for the most part, I'm like, there's not a bad day, man, because we've been through, whether it was basketball related BS or job searching, getting into the job, hating it so much. And I just remember Drew kept saying, man, look, man, I just know I'm better than this, man.
There's got to be something else.
There's got to be something else. So, but yeah, man, we appreciate you being on the show, man. We sure wish you were around when we were playing. It might have saved us some time trying to figure this thing out.
It happened the way it's supposed to happen. You need to figure it out the way you did.
I'm grateful. I'm just glad we did. And to all the student athletes out there, I hope that if they do have somebody on their team, or even if they don't, they find something or some way to cope with whatever they're going through without drugs, alcohol, and just doing things that might harm themselves now or down the road. So because we know mental health is real, man. It's real. And you know, sometimes, especially for men, we like to hold things in and we're going to be okay. And it's okay to go talk. It's okay to, we got to rethink, we got to rewire ourselves and our thought process, because just because you go, the strongest thing to do is to ask for help. That's the real thing. It's not, if I ask for help, I'm a punk or I'm weak or I don't want to share. Talk that thing out. It's important, man, because student athletes are dealing with stuff that I can't even fathom with this whole internet, social media, and this pressure. It's just way too much. So get some help if you need it out there.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mari.
There you go. You got it right.
We appreciate it. We
definitely appreciate you. Definitely.
Well, thank you for having me. I had a great time with y'all.
Absolutely. Well, enjoy the rest of your day.
All right.
I'm Kate.
Drew.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.